Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I have with me via Zoom, Hannah Maton. Hannah is the founding partner at Amply Ventures, a Stockholm-based venture capital firm specializing in early stage investments in Nordic B2B SaaS companies. With a focus on capital efficient businesses at the seed to pre-series A stage, Amply Ventures is redefining the investment landscape by working hands-on with founders to build scalable, sustainable businesses. Before stepping into venture capital, Hannah held senior commercial roles within the tech industry as Chief Commercial Officer at Soundtrack Your Brand and VP of Sales at iZettle in the years prior to their exit to PayPal, where she played pivotal roles in driving global growth. Her expertise in scaling B2B software businesses, particularly by building high-performing sales and marketing teams, is a cornerstone of her investment philosophy. Through her work at Amply Ventures, Hannah is committed to helping Nordic companies transition from founder-led operations to structured, scalable enterprises. Her deep operational experience, combined with her passion for sustainable growth, makes her a leading voice in the SaaS and venture capital ecosystems. In today's episode, we talk about whether Nordic startups have a tendency to undersell themselves.
If we build a product that's perfect, customers will come.
Why you shouldn't build in your basement and forget to tell the world about it.
You cannot spend years building something in your basement and then kind of forgetting to tell the world about it.
How the founder's job is to always be selling throughout the life cycle of the company.
A founder's job is essentially to sell.
And whether the future of venture is more concentrated portfolios where you're not reliant on a few companies to return the fund.
We typically talk about one, two companies kind of returns the entire fund.
Are we starting to see the start of software commoditization?
I'm not going to say that software is going to become commoditized, but it will to some degree.
And will the traditional SaaS pricing model change as AI proliferates more?
SaaS has been outdated for a long time.
How costs will become more aligned with consumption and value?
Lower costs and increase their spending as they grow.
And why Amply won't invest in founders who don't have a solid understanding of the financial fundamentals of their company.
When you come across founders that has a solid understanding of the financial principles of your company, and I think it can make all the difference in the world.
How working in sales in 2024 has been a massive test of resilience.
Working in sales in 2024 has been really a resilience test.
And finally, Hannah's contrarian advice: raise less money and spend what you raise on where it truly matters.
Make sure that you spend money wisely and where it truly matters.
Let's get straight into it.
This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it.
Hannah, really great to have you here with me via Zoom. You and I have spoken about the fact that Nordic companies have a tendency to undersell themselves somewhat. Can you talk me through the cultural and strategic factors that contribute to the Nordic region's strength in product development, but relative weakness in sales and marketing, especially given your perspective, having spent years at several years at Zettel before it exited to PayPal? And I guess, what are your insights into how this paradox affects the global recognition of Nordic companies and what strategies founders in the Nordics might be able to implement to overcome these challenges?
Yeah, so it's a big question, but I'll try my best. But I think just to put it into context, although I am Swedish, born and raised, I moved away from Sweden when I was 19 years old to go to university. I studied in London, and then I essentially was away from Sweden for 13 years, so my entire education and my kind of professional upbringing was done outside of Sweden and mainly in the US. So I spent 7 years in the US mainly working with sales and really, really growing tech startups. And then coming back to the Nordic 10 years ago, and stepped into the role as VP sales at Icetal, there was a lot of things that I just took for granted, and that was a bit of an eye-opener, I would say, going back to this topic, that my perception is that the Nordic countries, they have a reputation of building amazing products that are, you know, extremely innovative, beautiful, user intuitive, very well designed, but also like with a robust infrastructure behind them. If you think of like Skype, founded 2003, I believe, is a good example that goes away. But more recent example, Spotify, Klarna, and of course, Icetal that I had the pleasure of being part of for 3 years. And I think like there, the product team there at Icetal, led by the CPO Peter Stalle, they were almost artists in the way that they took extreme measurements to kind of create what was essentially just a point of sales card machine, right? But it felt extremely modern, upscale, and premier. Had nothing to do with the functionality. It was just the look and feel of the actual card. So when I came here 10 years ago, I was really kind of perplexed about the downplay that sales and marketing had and company strategy. And it was almost a sense that, well, if we build a product that's perfect, customers will come. Customers will find us. And so I sometimes nowadays, when I speak to entrepreneurs, joke around that you cannot spend years building something in your basement and then kind of forgetting to tell the world about it. It just doesn't work like that. And I think anecdotally, I had lunch with a senior, very senior CRO, chief revenue officer, the other day. He had just joined a Swedish company, rather big SaaS company, and he came from an American company. He was really baffled about the fact that Sweden had kind of thought the title sales had a very bad reputation, and it was almost perceived as something you did kind of early in your career, but you aspired to grow out of it quickly. My hypothesis is that I think that the Nordic culture plays a role. We play a high value on things like modesty, humility, and the culture here, societal, discourage kind of individuals from standing out or boasting about their achievements. So quite the opposite from the US culture. And I think that this cultural norm can kind of lead to more reserved approach in marketing or sales, where I almost feel like companies underplay their strengths and achievements because it's considered a brag, or it's considered ugly to brag about a feature or claim greatness, but it's more viewed that just test it out. We think we were right, but you know, maybe we can do better, and we're working on doing it better. So it's almost like the jantelag, which is the Swedish saying. So how do we overcome these? I mean, I think what we focus very much with the companies that we invest in is just educating them about the importance of sales. On you need to have a founder that understands that his or her job is to sell. That is going to be their job in their entire career. They sell to investors, they sell to banks, they sell to customers, they sell. I mean, a founder's job is essentially to sell. And I constantly kind of speak about the sales. You've built this amazing thing. Don't you just want to jump on top of a mountain and shout to everyone around it that, look at this, look at this. Aren't you so proud of it? And when you try to angle it like that, then you kind of break down the barriers of that sales is about convincing someone to buy something that don't necessarily need or want. But it's not an easy question. I don't think I have one single answer to it. But
I mean, there's a couple of things that I think, you know, really resonated there. I mean, the first thing is, when I think about the Nordics, I think about subtlety. I think about very, very clean, crisp design aesthetics. I mean, you know, we all, you know about the Scandi style of furniture. My wife is currently sort of studying interior design, so I see a lot of that. But then equally, you know, one of the most famous Scandinavian brands is obviously IKEA, where, you know, that whole sort of aesthetic of simple but functional, you know, not overstated is, it really comes through throughout the whole kind of the whole aesthetic of the company, right? Not just the furniture that they sell, but equally kind of how they market themselves and so on. So I can completely understand that sort of cultural aspect of understatement, of not overselling. And so that makes a huge amount of sense to me. But I would suggest that it's not just necessarily the Nordics. I mean, like, you know, here in the UK, you have this sort of almost derogatory way that sometimes people think and talk about salespeople, you know, coin operated monkeys, like essentially as long as they're earning their commission, their bonus, then, you know, that's what they're doing. And to your point, it's sort of this very junior sort of level way of looking at things. Whereas, you know, let's face it, sales are what drives a business forward, right? It's how you fund the business, you know, ultimately, you know, how you drive profitability through the business is via those sales. And I think that point about that educational piece, I mean, I think that, you know, what clearly stands out is, given the sort of work that you've done within the commercial space, being able to act as that kind of counterpoint to the founder, to the team, that no, okay, yes, product great, but if no one knows about it, it's sort of irrelevant. I think is super valuable. And would you say kind of other VCs within the Nordics have a similar kind of view, or do you think that Ampli very specifically has kind of understood that and internalized it and sees that as one of the main kind of driving points for their strategy, for your strategy?
I don't think that we are unique in this insight, but I do think that we are unique in the way that we have actually walked the walk, so we can actually do something about it. So a lot of the times, I speak to my fellow VC contacts, and they say, it's an amazing product. The founders are best, but they don't really know how to drive sales. They need help on the commercial input, which is also why we... Ampli is appealing to them, right? Because they want to bring us into their portfolio companies, and they want to bring us in front of and kind of co-invest, because we can actually, we understand it, and we can help them quite tactically on the go-to-market strategy, how to really build a storytelling around the brand that kind of resonates with your value with your ICP. And we can't just say, okay, or I guess we don't just say, well, we need to work on sales. We actually double click on that and say, this is how we're going to do it. And we break that down. And I think that hands-on approach can only be done with someone who has actually done that journey and been there. Yeah. And I don't think that's quite unique with us, I would say.
Yeah, amazing. Let's talk about Ampli actually, because you know, you've targeted a very concentrated portfolio approach as compared to kind of the traditional VC model. So can you explain how this fairly contrarian approach, certainly as far as venture capital is concerned, and talk me through how focusing on sustainable growth and strategic involvement with founders, in your opinion, could lead to better long-term success, and whether you believe this model could start overtaking the kind of more traditional venture capital landscape of sort of, you know, large portfolio, heavily diversified, looking for, you know, one or two moonshots.
Yeah. So absolutely. And I think it's important that the whole raison d'etre for Ampli was not necessarily to become a VC, but it was more to offer founders a different method, basically. So I think traditional VC models operate premise on diversification. You spread your investment across many startups with the expectation that a few will deliver kind of exceptional returns to offset the losses from another. So you typically talk about one, two companies kind of returns the entire fund and some, whilst maybe a majority doesn't really even survive or become successful at all. And I think this method or strategy, of course, reduces risk, but it does lead to kind of less personalized support, working really closely with the portfolio. And I think we started Amply because we were really passionate about working alongside founders. And that is what really gets us up in bed, not necessarily the investment part of it, but actually developing the companies together with our founders. And I think that involves us selecting a limited number of startups and investing more time, resources, and capital into each of them and stay with them longer. So I think it what it allows us to is we evaluate fewer companies so we can really kind of do more thorough diligence and become more informed about the market, the customers, and so on. And that can then lead to us giving a more of an enhanced support. So do more intensive kind of mentoring, strategic guidance, and operational support because we really, really know the company, the product, and the founders. And we believe, of course, that that's going to increase the likelihood of success. And that means that we build really kind of strong relationships with not just the founders, but the entire management team and the entire team. And we believe that is also kind of a very, very resilient way of not just support, but we feel like that is enabling our companies to kind of withstand market fluctuation, economic downturns, because we know them very well and we can guide them through that. But I think I doubt this model can kind of overtake the traditional VC landscape. But I think it would rather open up like for a new type of investors that can choose. And we're 2 years in, so ultimately the likelihood that more investors are going to apply this kind of method depends on, I think, our performance. And, if our kind of approach actually yields the higher returns and lower failure rates, I think it also has to do with market trends. So if we see that kind of the startup ecosystem evolves, the kind of growing recognition and trend of the importance of more sustainable growth, which we spoke about, right? And the need to have a very founder-friendly investor, maybe more VC firms may adopt similar approaches, which I kind of think that they are because we're seeing more and more operator backgrounds stepping into VCs. And then of course success stories. So I think if some high profile successes comes out of our portfolio, then it will lead to a higher demand kind of among founders and LPs, which will drive other firms to follow suit. And just more concretely, what we do is we most VCs says that they work really closely with the founders. We actually do work very, very closely to the point where we are almost in their Slack channels, speaking to them every day and really helping them, not just on a high level strategic level, but more so on a very operational part. We're obviously not working in the companies, but it can literally be almost on a daily basis that we do are in touch with them.
Yeah, so you're heavily involved in the execution, not just the strategy, right?
Exactly. Well put. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well
so essentially, I mean, what that leads to is hopefully founders having, more significant chance of success because, as we just said, like sales is the core, the commercial kind of operations of the business are core to the success. One question I actually had for you, for kind of following on from that, is so do you reserve quite a fair amount of follow-on capital for your portfolio? Is that right?
Good question. Yeah, good question. Up 40-50%. So
wow.
So our intention is not just to kind of protect our ownership stake, but is to really double down on the companies where we feel that there is a good fit.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, to your point around whether more VCs might follow this sort of trend, I mean, I personally believe that it makes sense in a world where software costs are coming down, where the sort of companies that we're seeing being funded, certainly here in the UK, I'm seeing a lot more kind of the deep tech businesses, life sciences, et cetera, receiving more capital as opposed to, say, software companies. But there are still clearly some breakout. Software companies, SaaS companies being built, but with the proliferation of AI, and we're going to talk about that as well in a second, but my feeling is it is going to be, I don't know if harder is the right word, but you are going to have to be much more considered in how you pick investee companies. And actually, therefore, in a world where there is just a proliferation of software, spending more time with those companies and really ensuring that they have the opportunity to succeed with your expertise, if you do have expertise, is a model that makes sense. Like, I think it very much is likely to be the trend, whether that becomes like a subset of venture capital or even sort of early stage private equity, I don't know. I can see why that might be adopted. I think a lot of people outside of the VC ecosystem have that feeling that a lot of people don't understand why that portfolio diversification approach is the VC approach, and I think there are a lot of people who would believe that actually building a sustainable portfolio of 10, 15, 20 businesses, all of which exit at nine figures, is much better than betting the house on one out of 70 that exits at a billion, right?
Well, end of the day, that's not why I went into investing. I would rather see, a 90% success rate among our portfolio, but maybe no unicorns in there, rather than one unicorn and 80% failure among the rest. So that, I believe in that, it's a much more sustainable way, and especially when it comes to software B2B, which is quite predictable business model, that in theory, growth is not spurred by injecting cash necessarily. And I think we understand that in a much better way than a general kind of VC that might invest in B2C, in hardware and deep tech and so on, that then it's not about just pouring into cash and that will then kind of lead to an accelerating growth path, not necessarily when it comes to software B2B. But I think, we'll talk about AI, but going back to sales and marketing, as I'm not going to say that software is going to become commoditized, but it will to some degree, right? It will become more commoditized. Then what is really going to drive uniqueness isn't that around the narrative, the brand, and your execution ability of getting in front of your potential customer and really, really explaining to them what problem that you're solving in the best way. And to me, that's sales and marketing. So I think the technology advances, from my personal point of view, is quite tickling, because it will ultimately, in theory, put more focus on sales and marketing.
Yeah, because software is no longer the moat, or might not be the moat, right? So let's talk about that, right? Because we have discussed the likely impact of AI on SaaS business models, and particularly the shift towards vertical specific solutions over horizontal platforms. So what do you think this will mean in terms of implications on pricing structures, be that usage-based billing, be that something else, and how AI-driven customization capabilities might reshape the whole SaaS market landscape?
I think that question, question alone is a podcast on its own, right?
So, of course.
I'll try to be as concrete as possible, but from my point of view, and I think traditional SaaS has been an upfront invoice, and you pay an annual or biannual in advance, and you kind of lock customers in there, and then next year comes around, you get an invoice that is 9% higher pricing than last year if you haven't really bought anything. And it doesn't really take into consideration how much you're using, the ROI you're getting it, for how long, is there seasonality on it? So it's been a very kind of the selling way of doing it. Like, this is my model, regardless of your needs, you're going to have to pay for a year in advance. And I think now, the subscription model, we're already seeing it, but it's kind of we'll continue to kind of evolve with even more flexible pricing structures and drive more towards usage billing. And I think that opens up to accommodating kind of different customer needs, different usage patterns, and really kind of aligning more cost with actual consumption and value. And I think So the annual upfront PDF invoice, I think, will diminish. I think we'll see more of a usage-based billing where AI-driven SaaS solution can provide kind of more of a granular insight into usage patterns, and then that can kind of transfer into more customized billing structures. So you as a customer can only pay for what you use. Transactions, data analyze, specific features, and so on, and not necessarily by the package and the pricing that someone like me has kind of put my finger up in the air and said, this sounds fair, but it's much more ROI driven. And I think this model, kind of companies converting into this model, it scales much better because it enables businesses to kind of start testing new tools, lower costs, and increase their spending as they grow. But ultimately, it's basically because they use the service more and they get more ROI on it. And I think you can attract a broader range of customers. So there's no longer questions, should we target enterprise or should we target SMBs? But you can, in theory, target and the entire and entire that kind of scale. You will just have very much flexibility in the average contract value that you will get. So I think that AI can kind of demonstrate that clear ROI by linking usage to business outcome. And that I think that's quite tickling. And to be frank, I think the packaging and the pricing of SaaS has been outdated for a long time. So that's something that I'm thinking a lot about. And what does that ultimately mean from a go-to-market point of view? Because you might no longer be enterprise company or an SMB focus, but you kind of need to. All companies need to convert over to a more of a product-led sales, and it's about fronting the product and your value proposition, your brand story, right? And making it easy for customers to test, understand the product, and then it's more about kind of following the customer as they grow in your product, or guiding them to what kind of level of product they need. Depending on the size.
Yeah, so I think it's the whole unbundling of that kind of software suite, right? Like
yeah.
To your point, that modular approach allows you greater flexibility in who you target, how you target them, but actually potentially captures a larger swathe of the market and probably improves retention actually for that matter as well, right? So hopefully you would see less churn because, you know, if I'm no longer being forced to spend $10,000 a year or $100,000 a year on a product, which, you know, 90% of the product is actually not valuable to my needs today. And therefore I might think twice about buying that product. Obviously, as a CFO, this is stuff that I think about a lot. Whereas if I can buy that 10% that's valuable to me today, I'm much more likely to then go be open to being upsold additional product features, et cetera, as I move along. And to your point, I do think that it's weird. We kind of got a bit lazy, I think, from a SaaS pricing perspective, right? In that it just was like, oh, well, actually, look, we'll just charge for the whole lot and then, you know, you deal with it.
Small, medium, big.
Yeah, but I think you know, consumers of B2B software are much more savvy, and especially in, you know, we talked about at the beginning, kind of the recessionary situation we're in. Like, you know, people like me are sitting there looking at costs and going, okay, where can we shave? Where can we save? And therefore, if you're smart as a vendor, you're going to look at ways that you can retain me into the future, which may mean sort of less immediate value, but actually larger sort of lifetime value over time, right?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think also like the purchase behavior of customers, software purchasing is becoming more and more democratized. So even enterprise customers are now behaving like consumers when they're out there shopping around. So you can no longer hide your product behind book a demo. You need to show it, and customers want to feel and test and so on. So in theory, I think if you can buy If you can buy a Tesla and customize that online without speaking to someone, you should be able to do that with the same with most of the software that's out there, I think. But I still hear this argument that it's so complex and we cannot show it and we don't want to display prices because then our competitors might see it. But I think that that's a dying belief and a way of thinking.
Well, there are so many communities where the data is shared. Like, I mean, you know, I sit on a bunch of kind of CFO WhatsApp groups, and like we're constantly asking each other, okay, has anyone used this product? What are your thoughts? What's the pricing like? What is it compared to, you know, XYZ competitor? Like, I think it's somewhat naive to suggest that that your pricing isn't visible, right? Like we're living in a high information age. If I want to find the price of your product, I can find it relatively quickly.
And I think that's a good point. And I think lots of companies can do much better at providing that guidance to customers. So instead of you asking in a WhatsApp group, you should be able to find it on my homepage. These are our competitors. This is the pros and cons. This is why you should use us and not them. But actually, if you're looking for them, this, you should be using them, not us. And because then you will be perceived as much more confident
And high trust.
and high trust, and also very, very, very focused on what kind of product you're building for whom. By almost disqualifying types of customers and proudly display your prices of you and your potential competitors. Very few companies does this when it comes to B2B as well.
And I would suggest that's the same in the service industry, not just sort of software.
Probably.
We're still working in like very outdated ways. So we've touched on a couple of these things, but so I'd really like to understand from your commercial perspective and also from a venture perspective, how important you think financial literacy is amongst startup founders and kind of what your experience has been when you're running due diligence on target companies, and how does Amply look to support companies through those sort of issues?
I think there's two types of founders here. One that has the financial acumen, and I think one that doesn't. And we would never invest in someone who doesn't because, like, it's quite obvious when you work with and conduct kind of due diligence. And companies and when you come across founders that has a solid understanding of the financial principles of your company. And I think it can make all the difference in the world in your ability to kind of navigate the financial landscape, the secure funding, and really maintain sustainable growth. And very, very seldom does the founders that we invest in has a head of finance or a CFO next to them, which is most typically most of the companies that we invest in are maybe 10 people, and six or seven of them are in R&D. So are developers and in tech. So quite understanding, but then you as a founder need to understand that you need to take your kind of MBA in finance, right? In theory. So you need to take on the CFO hat and really, really understand what's driving the business. What is the underlying risk in your model? How are you following? How can you really interpret kind of the financial statements accurately? Can you forecast? How accurate is your forecast to kind of see what your burn is, your financial needs, and kind of avoid those common pitfalls that can really derail your progress, right? And I think part of that is risk management, so understanding the risks and how to mitigate them, but also really understanding what is the underlying drivers in your business that is really, really affecting how quickly you can grow. And because then if you know those levers and you can kind of dial up a bit of a risk here, but it's calculating risk and to test a certain growth areas and so on, then I believe that you can essentially navigate the ups and downs of the early days in the startups much better. But we often come across founders that really has no idea on how to navigate in Excel and doesn't really understand the numbers in the Excel and can convert them into the business and link that into the strategy and the plan and so on. And then you need to either need to realize that you have this flaw and bring in someone that can, someone like like a very, very commercial driven CFO on their side. I think you need to realize that you might not become the startup success that you think.
Yeah, I think it's fine. I get a lot of, I don't know if it's pushback, but you know, people are like, well, it's not the CFO that builds a business. I'm like, yeah, I agree. It's not the CFO that builds a business, but often the CFO is guiding the business to like down that success path. Because, you know, in an era where you had very cheap money and there was lots of cash, I still remember a SaaS founder like 6 years ago telling me, well, you know, if I run out of money, it's fine. I'll just go out and raise again, right? Like they were that confident that they would just be able to go and raise some capital because it was that flush. But I think in a period where, you know, that access to capital is obviously diminished, you know, people are feeling the pinch. You need to be out there scaling the business via sales, via revenue, right? Like understanding how that cash flow works in your business is so critical to that growth, right? Because if you hire or fire or invest in the wrong area at the wrong time because you haven't understood your numbers, that could be absolutely sort of, you know, existential, fatal to the business. You're never going to hear me, you know, say that financials aren't important. I guess it would be pretty, ridiculous if I did. But
no, but I think a forward looking CFO can be a critical part of the company's success, and I've seen it, witnesses firsthand in the companies that I've been part of. You know, the Soundtrack and Mentimeter and iSettle and Wildfire. But I think needless to say, you don't have to bring that person in very early.
I agree.
I think in relation to or just before a Series A is probably the most suitable time. And I think it has a very, very positive effect, because if you have someone that can put a financial strategy in your company, and that then translates into the overall it's strategy of the business, you're very strong. And I think that can be the world of difference to a startup.
Yeah, but irrespective of that, and I think this is where we agree on all of this, but I think fundamentally, founders need to understand their numbers. Like, I don't think you can, think as a founder, you can get away with being financially illiterate. It just does not work. Certainly if you are trying to go down the venture capital route, but even if you're not, I mean, if you just simply don't understand what drives your business and how it works, it's very hard to scale a business. And again, we've seen companies, you know, doing actually really decent revenues, but we saw over time, and these were not venture-backed businesses, we saw over time their revenues were shrinking, their margins were shrinking, and their costs were exploding. And we're like, well, hold on a second, what's going on here? And it turns out they didn't have anyone financial. The founder is not financial, not interested in the numbers, very brand-led, very sort of product-led. And you know, it can be very hard to turn that around once it starts going down that sort of a path.
I absolutely agree, because you cannot outsource that, right? You need to have it in as part of your DNA and realize as a founder, you cannot outsource your financial destiny. You can certainly not outsource growth. So if I'm speaking to a founder and they say, well, and then we're going to bring in a head of sales so I can focus on building out the business.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of rings a warning bell to me. And also, if I'm talking to a founder and I said, okay, how's your pipeline looking? And they cannot recite their pipeline for the next month by not checking in with someone else or logging into HubSpot, then that's a big difference from someone that knows exactly what leads are in the pipeline, what stage they're in, how likely they are to come in, and so on. In the early days of your company.
I mean, even as a B2B service provider, like, I obsess over my pipeline. I'm like looking at it every minute of every day when I have the time, right? Like I know inherently who's paused, who's delayed, who's not responding, you know, what's looking like it's likely to close, when it's likely. You know, we track even things like conversion times, you know, down to days, so we can understand, you know, we've seen very large changes, I think. And this is a really, I mean, just, you know, as a corollary, I guess, you know, in 2024, we've seen lead times really expand. And I would assume for many companies, right, in the software side of things, they're seeing those lead times expand.
Hit rate going down. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially with enterprise, I guess, right? Like that becomes even tougher where those timescales are already 12, 18 months potentially.
Yes. Which is quite fatiguing, which is why everyone is looking forward to 2025. I think being working in sales in 2024 has been really a resilience test because what has worked before is now taking twice as long and needs as twice as many business cases and arguments and objection handling, and a true testament to the amazing salespeople who have managed to pull through until December. You're all worthy of a rest. But we do that too. I mean, I constantly obsess over our pipeline, and I constantly measure conversion, hit rate, what can we do better, what can we calibrate, are we spending enough time on the right things, what should we do less that doesn't really convert into anything, what should we do more of, and that's not sales to me, that's just business.
That's what you've got to be doing day to day. Look, Hannah, I think we could probably talk for a lot longer, but I have one final question for you.
Yes.
So what is one thing that you have contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is the hill that you would die on defending?
You did ask me this before, and I spend some time thinking about it, and I realize I'm probably very non-contrarian in my personal life, which was really devastating to find out about yourself, right? But I actually do think that as an investor, I very often, both on my personal side and also but mainly my professional side, I often actually advise and urge founders to raise less money.
Yeah.
And I think in theory it should go against everything I do, right? But I think really, really make sure that you spend money wisely and where it truly matters. And don't raise money for the sake of it. And be very frugal in your company journey, because it will give you the freedom to operate on a longer and really provide the sustainable business growth that your business needs. And if you're able to do it at a profitable level, amazing, not necessarily in the early stages, but really make sure that you know your business and put money where it really will affect the success of your company, and just forget about the rest.
I mean, These are joyous words to my ears. The CFO in me is just like awake and alive with passion for that. Listen, Hannah, it's been absolutely incredible having you on the podcast. For the listeners, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to find you on the web?
I think find me on LinkedIn. That's where I hang out most of my days.
Amazing. Look, Hannah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to be here with me today.
Thanks. Have a good one. Take care.